Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson here on Interpreter Foundation Radio this evening. A couple of important announcements that we want to get out of the way before we begin our program tonight. First of all of the current CruiseLady.com cruises have been canceled or postponed. So I'm sure that those of you who have signed up have already been contacted by Cruise Lady, but we do want to thank them for sponsoring us, and we'll have more to indicate about that a little later in the program. In addition, the Moses Conference, which was sponsored by the Foundation Interpreter Foundation, which was originally scheduled for May 1st and 2nd, is going to be moved to a couple of dates in September, and we'll give you that a little later in the program as well. In the meantime, I've got my co-hosts on the phone with me tonight. We have John Gee with us. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Terry. Good
and
evening, listeners.
Kevin Christensen.
Nice to be sort of here.
Sort of. We're all here. What do you mean?
Yeah.
And this is
well, I'm in Pennsylvania. We're social distancing on a grand scale.
Really? Yes. Well, we're just following the example of the brethren from last week. I mean, I don't know about you, but seeing the first presidency spread out like that was a little disorienting for me.
It was also interesting. There was a shot on one of the church's news sites of conference where they're shooting into the auditorium where the audience would sit. And there were about, you could see the brethren on the stand in front, and then you could see maybe five of the speakers in the audience, all seated in many rows apart.
Yeah.
And pretty much an empty, it looked like they'd kept to the government mandate of no more than 10 people in a gathering. And it was a very different conference.
Yeah, you know, I was going to begin today by talking about Easter, and we want to welcome our listeners and those who are on the podcast later and wish you a happy Easter. And I have to tell both of you that this has been one of the best Easters, if you will, and you hate to rank things, but it is one of the most memorable Easters for me. It was very spiritual and moving. I heard from people I haven't heard from in a long time. I, you know, communicated with a mission companion in England as he and his family were sitting down to their evening meal. And it was just a wonderful experience. And then to have it come on the heels of the fast that we did on Good Friday. And I don't know, I'm fairly new to Facebook. And so I've been putting on some of my book reviews from my radio program in St. George. And, you know, I've been just kind of learning the ropes, if you will, about Facebook. And there was a very large group of people who reported on the fast on Friday. I read some very moving testimonies from people, both LDS and non-LDS, which was very interesting to me that. And there's a 500,000 people, I think, on this Facebook page who participated in the fast in the group, and it was just really inspiring to me to see people come together like that, and then to have it be silent. This morning we watched Andrea Bocelli do a live performance, if you will, although he didn't call it that, from the Duma in Milan. And it was he and the organist, obviously the camera people, but that was it.
You could actually see one of them in one of the shots, but yeah, they were definitely keeping their distance there.
Yeah, and I loved what he said about the first. It was very moving to me where he said, "I, you know, recognize and believe in the Christian Easter." He said, this isn't a concert, this isn't a performance, it is a prayer for the world. and people are welcome to join me in prayer and singing. And I felt connected through the technology in a way that I never had before. And following on that was a rebroadcast of, you know, Handel's Messiah, which, frankly, the only thing music I ever listen to in my car when I do, and I'm in the car a lot going back and forth between Northern Utah and St. George, is Handel's Messiah. Oftentimes I have an audiobook going on because of the program that I do down there, but when I do listen to music, the Messiah is generally what I listen to. So I've had a very moving Easter experience, and I just felt that the world and many of the people in my circle are paying more attention. And obviously the virus and the situation and the struggles that everybody is going through and is going to go through, it gives me some hope that we are turning to God rather than, like the Nephites at the end, turning away from God and being angry that he won't let us continue in our sins. But I was wondering, perhaps, Kevin, and then John, you could share some of your Easter and fast experiences with the audience.
Well, for the fast this week, we woke up on Friday and didn't think about it, and we talked about it later, and then I fasted on Saturday. And it was a good experience to me. But one of the things that's been moving for me this week was, you know, particularly we watched some video blogging from a guy who's been a nurse in New York City, and he said he'd been, you know, on some reality show and 10 or 15 years ago, and then decided to become a nurse. And he said he kind of envisioned his life that he'd work for some cosmetologist, and it'd be like gossiping with you know, people like on the, you know, the Real Housewives of, you know, wherever. Then he volunteered to go to New York, and he said because he's a bigger guy, they gave him the job of, you know, when someone has died, he's the one that puts on the toe tags and helps move them around. And just, you know, the solemnity that he had, you know, over what he was doing and the importance of it and the burden that they were carrying, that, you know, one of the, did make me think about, you know, the Book of Mormon, chapter 18 on Mosiah, where it talks about bearing one another's burdens. You know, there's somebody that's really involved in that, and we, you know, watch doctors and that. And it's, they talked about how in places like New York and Los Angeles, we've seen videos of when the shift changes for the hospital, that all of the people within, you know, several blocks will open up their windows and just applaud and cheer to let the people on the front lines of this know that they're not alone, and in a sense to try and share their burdens that they may be light. And knowing that they're all quite heavy for a lot of people, and it's real stressful. And you know, we've seen reports directly from doctors, nurses, several that we've seen, and it's always very touching. This Easter, just in our house, you know, Sean and I are empty nesting, have been for years, so we were able to talk to our son for a couple of hours on the phone and talk to my daughter and our two granddaughters to see them and feel the thing. And remembering just a few days ago, it was my mother's 101st birthday. You know, she said last year we had her 100th birthday in the Lion House in Salt Lake. This year, she's with all of the social distancing. She's got my brother and his two boys living with her. But when she got up on her birthday and looked out the front door, and there were dozens of balloons that had been set up on the front yard. And then she said her bishop called up and said to put a chair on the front porch, and that he'd come by and talk to her from a distance. But so she set up a chair on the front porch, and just about everybody in the ward drove by and shouted happy birthday to her. You know, it's something she didn't expect. So this idea that, you know, she felt like that she wasn't alone, and that she, you know, she felt like at 101, she feels like she's the last leaf on the tree of the generation that she knew and all the people that she knew. But that she's known and people care about her and take an interest in her, it's really uplifting. So, there are those kinds of things that are very touching, and life is good for us here, and we're happy to try and think of ways to share one another's burdens. My wife has been sewing face masks for people in our family.
And 101. We talk about that every month. John's mom, she's 100. Well, now she's 101. If she goes a little while, she'll beat Eldridge Smith.
We talked for years. We've been talking about her like the energizer bunny, and she's just sharp as tack and knows what's going on and is active and taking care of herself. And it's just pretty amazing.
Well, that's great. It's good to hear.
That's wonderful.
Yes. John?
There have been lots of really wonderful things about this Easter, but one of the ones that surprised me is that on Saturday, Queen Elizabeth released an Easter address. She's never done one before.
Yeah, the green dress. Bright green dress.
No, she's...
You're talking about the address, not the speech?
It's the little speech she gave.
The speech.
Yeah. 2 minutes. And it's been very difficult to find a copy of it, but she said a couple of things in it that you don't expect from the Queen of England. Just because you don't really think about that with the Queen of England. She says, and I'm quoting here, that she's talking about lighting candles. It's a way of showing how the good news of Christ's resurrection has been passed on from the first Easter by every generation until now. Easter isn't canceled. Indeed, we need Easter as much as ever. The discovery of the risen Christ on the first Easter day gave his followers new hope and fresh purpose, and we can all take heart from this. And ends by saying, I wish everyone of all faiths and denominations a blessed Easter. And so, you know, usually with the royal family, you're not even thinking about what they believe.
It's a tabloid situation as opposed to a religious kind of discussion.
Right, but, you know, and Queen Elizabeth generally stays out of the tabloids. But to have her talk about the risen Christ and wishing everyone a blessed Easter and is, I think, wonderful. It's not something I expected, and she's never had given an Easter address before. But to have someone of her stature express in the public square in a country that's largely non-believing her own faith in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is amazing. Who would have thought of this? And it's just a wonderful thing. And since it is Easter, I want to share with the listeners who don't know about this my favorite Eastern Orthodox Easter tradition. They greet everyone with saying Christos Anesti, which means Christ is risen. And that's the greeting on Easter, and the response is Alithos Anesti, he truly is risen. And
can we say that in English? Because you know how I struggle with
pronunciation. I just translated it for you.
I know that, but I struggle with pronunciation, as you know.
Oh, yeah, but can we say that in English? Why not? It's just a wonderful way of
tradition. Yes.
Of expressing their belief in the central event, or central fact of Christianity. It's a wonderful thing, and it's a tradition worthy of borrowing.
Yes.
Christ is risen. Yes, he truly is risen.
He truly is risen. And that's something I don't think we can stress enough of. And to get back to your point about the Queen, one of her titles is Defender of the Faith.
Yeah.
And so I,
but we haven't seen much of that.
Well, we, yeah,
it's, nice.
They,
it's still there.
Away from that, but it's still there. It's kind of like that anointing that they get when they are crowned. I mean, to kind of jump ahead a little bit, she's not going to live forever. And when she does, there's going to be a new coronation. It has never before been publicized, that ceremony, but it is part of the coronation. I first ran across it, I think, in one of Hugh Nibley's articles, but then since I've subsequently done some research on that independently from just regular English historical sources. And it's a fascinating tradition that, you know, and you can't, at least I can't help but, you know, visit the Tower of London and see the orb or the scepter or whatever it is without thinking of the religious symbolisms involved with that. So I think the Queen realizes that the people really need that message and has brought it forward at this time. And it just shows the serious nature of where she feels the country is right now.
Yeah. Well, one other little pendant note. As far as I'm aware, she is the world's longest reigning monarch ever. She's been a queen longer than Ramses II was. And although Pepi II is claimed in a couple of sources to have reigned for 92 years, the contemporary sources don't back that up. So with that one possible exception, which isn't confirmed with contemporary sources, no monarch in the history of the world that we know of has reigned for longer.
Yeah, she's going longer than 60 now. What was she, 60? I want to say 66, 67?
No, I think she's 67. Ramses II was 66. So,
I think Kevin's mom could have done it. She's been the matriarch of the Christensen line, so would that count?
Yeah, well, we can't all be Kevin's mom.
But,
but that's... I have always appreciated the Queen and her sense of duty and just, you know, desiring to get on with it. But the comments that you've brought up make me more impressed with her than it.
Yes.
And my friends in England who don't appreciate the royal family, I hope they're taking note and maybe this will change their opinion a little bit.
Well, they can't all be bad monarchs.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So when we were on the air together a month ago, we did our Come Follow Me section about Easter because, you know, we finished that two-week segment and we go into a new Come Follow Me, and which we'll do in the next hour. But I'm wondering, Kevin and John, as we've, the last couple of weeks, as you pondered the Easter story and kind of, you know, related that to the Book of Mormon or not, what kind of impressions that you had? I have been focused again on the rending of the veil that's described in Matthew, Luke, Mark, and then, you know, what we know and have learned about the about Jesus' visit to the dead and the opening of the way, if you will. And I've been just super impressed by that and just reviewing materials that I have and have written or studied or prepared. And just that to me is something that is barely touched on in the scriptures, but it seems to have a lot of import. And so...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, there's that tradition of the, you know, they call the tradition of the harrowing of hell. I believe Nibley has written a bit about that, and so have a few others of his teaching there. But and those are very interesting to read, especially because they are directly comparable to what goes on in 3rd Nephi. But one thing that, especially now that I've been thinking about, is the vision of the redemption of the dead, which is, you know, ties directly into that, you know, the descent and the teaching to the spirits before the resurrection. One of the things that I've thought about is that when Joseph F. Smith was pondering, one of the things that led him to ponder what he was pondering was the flu epidemic. And, you know, it came as a shock to me when I learned that the flu epidemic in 1918 and 1919 killed more people than World War One.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and part of the death toll was because the most of the countries, because they were involved in the war, there were government controls on information. And that they were, because they wanted to keep morale up, they were trying to limit, you know, stuff that would be discouraging to the population. And that, of course, led to more deaths. So with all of this kind of thing going on, then that was with so much death. And that was one of the reasons why he was pondering so much the importance of understanding the resurrection and the questions that he had about all of these people whose lives were being cut short. And to have that kind of message that we have is, I think it's, to me, it's, very inspiring. Some of the speakers at conference talked about it a bit, but it is one of the things about the gospel message that, you know, through the temple we have, you know, this obligation, you know, to that they without us, we without them cannot be made perfect, and they without us. And there's that interconnection and interdependence of our lives, and that we can do things for one another, even sometimes if we feel, what can we do? But yet, you know, like, my wife is a nurse, but she has, she's been retired for a few years, and she's got exactly the kind of health issues that would she'd be at severe risk. And of course, she worked in with babies, and that wouldn't prepare for what's going on. But she's feeling this urge to do something, and that's why she learned how to make face masks. And, you know, her niece came over, and, you know, from her distance, we gave their family some of these that she's made. But just, what can we do to bear one another's burdens that they may be light? And because Christ bore our burdens, and he's trying to lighten them through the gospel message, that if we know that, whatever is going on, there is always hope. Maybe difficult, trying times that are heartrending and harrowing, but still, in all of it, the idea that there's hope and meaning. And I think about when I got my strongest, you know, initial personal witness that was really mine, that was really strong just before my mission. It was in reading the Book of Mormon. I was going through it for the third time, you know, laying on the bed in the basement, going through it, you know, just as part of my mission prep on my own. And I read Ether 1239, where Moroni says, "And then shall you know that I have seen Jesus Christ, and he spake with me face to face in plain humility, as a man speaks to his friend concerning these things." And when I read that, it just really touched me that had happened, which meant that Jesus was risen. Otherwise, there would be no conversation. It also meant to me also that Moroni was a real person too, but that Jesus was risen and that he would speak in plain humility. And to have that kind of intimate concern on behalf of deity is a thing that to me is, you know, it's a marvelous work and a wonder. You know, from the hymns, "Oh, it is wonderful, wonderful," to me, to think of that. It's very touching and something that we need in times like this, in times when we lose loved ones or know people who have or face things that are difficult. That there is love that is urging us to bear one another's burdens and lighten them. And that he will bear ours and help us with ours.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the vision of the redemption of the dead by Joseph F. Smith, Kevin, because about 10 mm-hmm. years ago, in the Journal of Book of Mormon and Other Restoration Scriptures, and you can find that on the Scholars Archive at BYU, there was a three-part series. And the first part was about specifically the harrowing of hell, salvation for the dead in early mm-hmm. Christianity. But the third part was specifically the vision of the redemption of the dead by Joseph F. Smith. And, you know, yeah. I have heard that about the influence of the flu epidemic of 1918 on that vision, but I had not thought of it again until you just brought it up. And it's time flies. It's 10 years old since those articles came out, but they're for me, it feels like it was yesterday, and I presume it may be the same for you and for the listeners. But John, what have your thoughts been over the last couple of weeks as you've talked about or studied the Easter?
On Easter, I think I've just been thinking about the reality of it. That, you know, this is something that actually occurred, that we have, in ancient times they could point to over 500 eyewitnesses to the resurrection. And when they went around in the early church, you could go places where people in those branches of the church had actually witnessed Jesus' resurrection. You could hear it from people who knew it firsthand. And that's I think if we, there's those promises in the Doctrine and Covenants that we can all, consistent with the Lord's will and with our preparation, we can experience that. So, you know, you may have a number of people who could testify firsthand. But for most of them, it's so sacred that you wouldn't know it. But it's not like we're completely lacking in witnesses even today. And it was reiterated in the proclamation about... It's implicit in there, but it's reiterated in, for example, the Living Christ, that there are living witnesses of Jesus in these days. And so those are some of the things that I've been thinking about over the Easter season. Other than how fast it creeps up on you.
How fast Easter creeps up, or how fast the...
It's Easter already? I thought we were getting ready for Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras is not on my calendar, thank you very much.
Well, usually Mardi Gras is preparatory for Lent, which is 40 days before Easter, and so when that comes up, then, you know, you need to prepare for Easter, and somehow this all just slipped by me this year.
So. Yeah, well, the last 40 days has been has slipped by all of us, I think, to a certain degree. It's amazing how much different the world is at this moment, and when we go back, there are things I hope we go back to quickly, and then there are other things where I like some of what's happening. I like the fact that we are thinking more about God, and we are pondering more about our place and how we can help one another. You know, General Conference was an interesting experience. There were certain parts of it that just felt like a normal conference. And then there were other parts that, were very different. And I'm wondering, how much of it was changed by the changes brought about by the virus versus what their original plans were for a celebration or something like that.
Well, I know there were a lot of people that right after, within a week of them announcing that in October that this would be a general conference unlike any before, that hotel rooms in the Palmyra area were completely booked out for conference weekend. And so
Kevin,
a number
was just
going to
commute. He had a parking space reserved, but that was it. Right,
yeah, but a number of people, you know, I don't know if the church had planned it. And it obviously planned some of it because they filmed some of this stuff last fall. You know, but I don't know if they'd made any plans to do anything in Palmyra, but that some of the members did, and that certainly changed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you come up to a conference and you hear rumors of this and that, and I didn't hear a lot of speculation on things like we had in the past, but I think a big part of that is it was overcome by the fact that, oh, you know, we're having church at home now, and, oh, we're having conference with the choir and the general authorities, but nobody in the audience, and then, oh, wait a minute, we're just going to record the choir, and we're going to have they want to be responsible global citizens, is
yes.
how they put it. And so we have a socially distanced, you know, conference.
That's important.
Yeah.
That they took actions and decisions to become part of this, accepting the reality of what's going on and to help one another, because it's not just about, you know, ourselves. And, you know, because there's been people saying, you know, I'll take my chances, or that, you know, God wouldn't let anything bad happen to me if I did something silly. But I'm really impressed. And
is that in the scriptures anywhere, Kevin? Can you find that phrase? God won't let anything happen to us if we do something silly.
Well, I can find that in the teachings of Joseph Smith, where he talked about some people decided that it was all right for them to tease some snakes. There's a story about that where Joseph Smith said that, no, he's not going to. This isn't a game. You're not supposed to play with this stuff. He's not going to.
I was impressed because the church said we are not bringing in any of the area presidencies for general conference, and they made that announcement before any governments were canceling flights.
Yes.
And it was all part of this, we're going to be responsible global citizens. And, you know, maybe having two former physicians and the leading councils of the church may have had an impact on that. I don't know, but the brethren knew as soon as it was that this is a problem, and before it really struck home how bad this was, they were already
ahead of the curve.
I have neighbors who were sent home from their mission earlier to quarantine before Italy became the world's hotspot. And yet, you know, they've acted not rashly, but very responsibly and early.
And that's the leadership that saves lives, instead of trying to pretend it's not there until you're forced to. And then, you know, we've heard people talking about, well, why don't we just let people, you know, give themselves a sacrifice themselves for the economy, you know.
There's a political element to it that we're not going to get into here. But I do think that once again, it was there were elements of the conference for me that were unique and that were helpful, and then there were other parts of it that was just it was about the same. Some of the talks that were given.
The interviews that took place in Palmyra, I thought were very striking.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as very, very special and interesting. And the children speaking on Saturday night was really unexpected and beautiful. And of course, the announcements about the temples, where the temples were. We're getting one in Pittsburgh, and I've known people who have just been very anxious to get one here. But quite frankly, I was more stunned by Shanghai and Dubai and Congo.
Came from the government. They said they made a very public point announcing that.
Yeah.
Well, they also made very public points about the temple in Shanghai.
Yes.
And
it won't be open to outsiders, and it won't be a tourist spot. It'll be just for national Chinese who are there.
By appointment.
Yes.
And I think that's really important given the current situation in China. And there are people who, way back when, certainly within all of our memories, you could reasonably make it a goal to attend a session in all of the temples throughout the world.
There's an Instagram person who has little posts, and she calls herself LDS Temple Chaser, and I believe that's her goal. And
well, there are people who tried to keep that goal as the number of temples have increased. Now it's a much more daunting task.
Yes,
not simply the numbers, but all the locations and the logistics of getting there and everything. But President Nelson was pretty clear that you're not going to do this with Shanghai.
No. Well, and it reminds me of when we got the temple in East Germany, back when there was an East Germany, if you recall. I think that was 1985, and I'm not sure how old you were at that time, John. Kevin is older than me, I know, but I know you're younger. And so I just distinctly remember, first of all, I think President Benson was the prophet then, and he had been such a crusader politically against communism that I remember being a bit surprised that they would allow the church to put it there, number one. And number two, well, wait a minute. We're able to build a temple in a communist country behind the Iron Curtain. I remember just wondering about the logistics of that and how that would work. And I remember reading in President Monson's biography about how he worked with officials and with local church leaders who were behind the Iron Curtain in order to make that happen, and then getting the films over there for the endowment. And I think it was President Hinckley who was kind of over that. And just that whole logistics of that, it reminds me of what we're doing in Shanghai right now, where we are working with the government, a government that, has a lot of criticism directed against it, and probably much of it valid, but still, it is more important for the kingdom of God to go forth. And therefore, we are working with that government to secure the ordinances and the rights to the temple for the people there.
There's a lot that the brethren know that we don't have any clue of. And I think bringing up the East German example is an important example, because I don't think any of us realized that President Monson had been working nearly 20 years the government's there as an apostle. And by and large, the general membership of the church had no idea that this was going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are likewise things that are going on with the church in China that that none of us need to know about, but are going on. And the Lord is in charge, and He's directing the affairs, and so this is happening. Dubai was both of those were somewhat of a shock. Pittsburgh for you, Kevin, is the big one. Tallahassee is a big one for me, for family reasons. But you know, this work is going forward, and you know, and who would have thought we'd get another one in Nigeria? And so,
well, isn't it the second one in Congo as well?
Yeah, second one in Congo, and then in India.
Yeah.
You know that. I think if you ask most people, we wouldn't have known that. They would have thought, well, the church might be among some patriots in India, but they probably don't know about missions there, and certainly I don't think anybody was really expecting a temple, unless you're on the ground there.
Well, I remember seeing President Nelson visit India, and, you know, the videos that they showed and everything, and I thought, wow, there's a lot more church there, but when you think about how many people are there, it's pretty easy to get enough together for a temple. And but it's something that's under the radar, like you said. We just don't notice it.
Well, we have things that happen in our daily lives, and we don't have the worldwide vision. Most of us, if you were to ask what the church is doing two states away from us, if we're in the United States, we probably don't have much of an idea. And to see what's going on in far-flung countries. And if you really want to get a prize on it, go back to President Kimball's his message, I think it was to something like to all the world. It was a video that the church produced
go
back
in
like 1974.
World. Yeah.
And
it was based on his address to the regional representatives when he first became a prophet. And I remember that movie and that video because they showed it to us in Aaronic Priesthood all the time.
I got to see it once or twice, but what's amazed me is how spot on he was.
Oh, I know it. I know it. When
and
I
where they were going to go and when they were going to go and what the program was.
Yeah.
And that's all laid out almost 50 years ago.
Well, within 15 years, the Iron Curtain had fallen, but I distinctly remember him saying in that video, why should the Lord remove the Iron Curtain or the Bamboo Curtain or any other curtain if we're not, you know, meeting our obligations? And he won't do that until local missionaries are able to meet the needs of their own countries, and then we will be able to move forward in this great work. And I remember he had the arrow and the big globe and everything. In fact, John, you can find that movie on YouTube.
I bet you probably can. But the other thing is you know, nobody was paying attention when he talked about going to Africa.
Yeah.
And
well, at that time, we didn't because we didn't have the priesthood there.
Right. I mean, but he talked about going to Africa, and sure enough, we announced two temples there. Within nobody would have predicted that back in 1974.
Yeah.
Maybe President Kimball was, but...
He was a forward thinker in every way.
It's incredible to see the church move into these various places and bless the lives of local people.
So, Kevin, what is your recollection of President Kimball's? Because you are a little ahead of both of us. We got that when I was in Aaronic priesthood, and John got it a few years later when he got to that age. But you were, I think you were already a missionary then, weren't you?
Yeah, we watched, I remember watching when he became the prophet, and we watched the film about, like New Stride going into all the world. And I remember, you know, I think at the time I went on my mission, you know, there were like 15,000 missionaries, and we thought that was an immense step forward.
There were 18,000 when I was there, yeah, and then probably more.
Yeah, so I went on my mission in 73, September 73 to September 75 to England. And we, you know, we did feel this, you know, increase of things. But one of the things that really stunned me was after I got back on mission, I remember picking up the church news and reading an article about how the church was experiencing some very, very, a period of very strong growth in England. And, you know, when I was there, it wasn't, you know, it was kind of a sense of, there was growth, but it wasn't, you know, rapid or extreme. It's just, you know, it's a difficult mission, not as difficult as my wife's mission in France, but still. But and this is an article about a stake missionaries in Preston, and they're talking about baptizing more people in their stake than our entire mission used to do in a year. And this kid that was the stake mission leader, you know, I'd known in Preston, and he'd been the son of the stake president, and the first time I'd seen him, he was telling somebody else about the Black Knight scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So, and then to read, you know, this kind of leadership that he was doing is very impressive. And sometimes it can be just the times. You know, there was preparation that had to be done. You know, there were things that happened in the 60s that needed to be cleaned up, and I was kind of involved in the cleanup. And then after the preparation, we got Preston and Liverpool became stakes. And then I went home, and then, you know, other things happened, and there was this, you know, this period of very strong growth. And these things can happen at certain times. And I think back, you know, just sometimes, you know, that we know that helping you to see that God is in charge. You know, I remember, you know, reading about how, you know, it was after... In Joseph Smith's time, you know, after, you know, the trouble in Kirtland and the failure of the Kirtland Bank, and when half the church apostatized, and then Joseph sends, you know, the apostles, his strongest supporters, he sends them off to England. But the England that he sends them to is this England where, like when the missionaries show up in the Manchester, you know, Karl Marx and Engels are in Manchester writing Das Kapital, because they're seeing this nation that's where people are anxious for some kind of change. The Industrial Revolution has been such a disruption, and people's lives are changing. So people, when the missionaries come around to knock or preach at the corners and they hear about them, instead of saying not interested, they are. Because their life has been shaken up, and they start looking for something new. And then these people come over, and then that reminds me of, you know, when we went to a tour of Nauvoo, and one of the guys in the blacksmith shop knew a lot of church history about this, and he said it was these people that came from England that invented the techniques that let them build the wagons that helped them go do the migration to Utah. And so the sense that, you know, we have our little bits of the mosaic, but there's a God out there placing it. in these little bits of our lives that we don't really see the big picture. But when we just step back, sometimes you get a glimpse that, yeah, God really knows what's going on. And
yes,
and that there is a plan. And there is
a step-by-step process, yes. So,
yeah.
So, you guys, 20 years ago, we got a proclamation on the family from President Hinckley. And at that time, it seemed like it was, okay, yeah, that's pretty obvious. But now it stands out. And so we have a new proclamation, John. And we were talking a little about this earlier before we went on the air. But I wonder how, I mean, you know, it's hard to predict. And I don't want to question why the brethren did what they did or said what they said. There's always people carping online about it. But I'm thinking, well, 20 years from now, will it be standing out the same way that the proclamation to the family does now? What are your feelings for both of you? And we've got about 2 minutes apiece. So we'll start with you, John, and then we'll go to Kevin. Where do you think this is headed?
Okay, so 25 years ago, we got the proclamation on the family. 20 years ago, we got the living Christ. I've been waiting for the shoe to drop on the living Christ. There's some indications of it, and the brethren have warned us it's coming. But one of the things that impressed me about the proclamation on the restoration is you can go count. And usually when we think about the restoration, we think Joseph Smith. Jesus Christ is mentioned more than three times as often as Joseph Smith in that proclamation. I think one of the things they want us to get into our heads is that this is Jesus' church. This is his restoration. He is the author, and he is the most important person in it. And it's not that the work that Joseph Smith did is denigrated at all. It's just the emphasis is on the living Christ and his role in the restoration, which far eclipses Joseph Smith. We haven't been thinking that way, I think, in the church. And I think the brethren are rightfully nudging us in that direction. And other things that pop up is it explicitly says that the Book of Mormon is an ancient work.
Yes.
This is ancient scripture, and it really happened. And they also emphasize that there was really an apostasy. Or at least they mention it there. And given so as few words as are in there, anything that does get mentioned is emphasized. And I've seen movements in the church away from both of those.
Yes.
And I think the brethren saying, no, this is, there's nothing new that they've been saying here. Except I think the emphasis on Christ is new and is important. And I think that's significant. We need to pay attention to it.
Okay, Kevin? 2 minutes.
2 minutes, yeah. Well, this it's an important time, you know, to proclaim that God loves his children when these things are going on in the world. And the witness, you know, again, of the resurrection, of the atonement, and that it's all going on, that it's not long ago and far away, but that there's this immediate and continuation and direct connection with what was happening then. And that's some of the exciting part about it, and that is going on. This is one of the things that I, and this article that I wrote this week, actually, it's emphasizing, again, the case that, yeah, we should be able to stand up and treat the Book of Mormon like it is an authentic ancient scripture. You know, that it's the real deal, that it's and that it testifies of Christ, but it does so, you know, not in a metaphorical way or not in a poetic way, but it is a witness of by ancient prophets of the resurrection and that you know, God is involved with us today, and that this priesthood is real, all of that Yeah, that's exciting work. I think back to BNC3, which is one of the earliest writings we have. It was given when we had nothing. You know, Joseph Smith had lost the pages.
He had nothing going for him
but failure, and yet everything that revelation says has come to pass already. You know, it's remarkable. And so these things, yeah, we should take them seriously. Okay. There's authority there.
All right. Thank you, Kevin and John. That wraps it up for the first half of our broadcast this evening. Want to mention to you the Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by Cruise Lady Latter-day Adventures and Explore the World with the Latter-day Saint Scholar. We'll be right back after the top of the hour news break for our second half of the Interpreter Foundation radio program.
Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson, sitting in with John Gee and Kevin Christensen, my co-hosts for the second hour of Interpreter Foundation Radio. We are brought to you this evening by the Cruise Lady, Latter-day Adventures. Now, we want all of our listeners to know that the Interpreter Foundation's Book of Moses Conference, as I mentioned in the last hour, was originally scheduled for May 1st and May 2nd. It has now been moved to September 18th and 19th later this year. So check the website for details. The Interpreter Radio Show, as I mentioned, is sponsored by Cruise Lady, and you can join supporters of the Interpreter Foundation on the Ultimate Egypt Tour with Egyptologist John Gee, who's on the air with us tonight, and Professor Dan Peterson on November 20th of this year. So you'll see the best of Egypt, the pyramids at Giza, the temples of Luxor and Karnak, the Valley of the Kings, and the magnificent Temple of Ramses II at Abu Simbel. And John will correct my pronunciation on those if they're too far off. But space is limited for this cruise.
That's just not needed.
So call Cruise Lady at 801-453-9444, or you can find more information at cruiselady.com. So you can go to cruiselady.com, as I just mentioned, or call them at 801-453-9444. And they have some cruises that were scheduled. I'm sure those are being postponed or refunded or something. You can call Cruise Lady for those details right now. But the one on Egypt is still going on at the present time. So we just want to thank them for making it possible. Also want to mention that the Interpreter Foundation is a tax-deductible organization, and all of your funds that you donate to it can go for a write-off on your taxes. But most important, everybody who works with Interpreter, with a couple of minor exceptions, is a volunteer. And so all of the articles that you get every week are put online, they're updated, they're edited, they are peer-reviewed. A massive amount of work goes into it, and in the last month, they hit their 400th consecutive Friday of releasing at least one article. And so it's just something that comes to my phone every Friday, and I really appreciate it. I don't, you know, some of the articles intrigue me more than others, but that's the nature of it, and that's the beauty of it. But there are some that have basically changed the way I study the scriptures. Many of them have had a good influence on my life. The one this week by Melissa Anue is a very powerful personal discussion about her battle with cancer and how her feelings about the Savior and about adversity and God and everything have kind of played into that. And so I would just encourage you to go to the Interpreter website and sign up for the articles and find out a way that you can help contribute, because everything that you contribute is going to go to something worthwhile that you'll feel good about building the kingdom and helping get information out that people can benefit from. So you John and Kevin, our Come Follow Me segment this time is Mosiah chapters 18 through 24. And we start basically with baptismal covenants. And so several years ago, I taught a lesson on Leviticus. And we were talking about the ancient temple and how there were different levels of contamination, if you will, by the sins of the people. And it struck me how much of that was kind of similar to our baptismal covenants that are described in Mosiah 18, where we mourn with those that mourn and bear one another's burdens. And so I guess the question that I would ask you as we begin this segment is, where is the line, if you will, between our bearing one another's burdens, if you will, and strengthening those who are struggling, whether it's testimony, whether it's sin or addiction or anything else, versus our own, you know, at some point they are ultimately responsible for their own actions. But I think to a certain degree, we're responsible to the degree that we don't keep our covenants. So where do you think that line falls, I guess, would be the first question. Kevin? You deal with addicts all the time.
Well, I think it just in terms of instead of thinking about lines, just recognizing that that this is a place where you need the Spirit to guide you. This is why we need the Spirit in these situations. We have the general principle and recognize that we're in this together. You know, and then earlier on, Benjamin has been talking about this need for balance, that it's necessary to be diligent, but then you're not supposed to run more than you have strength. And we all have different talents and aptitudes, and at different times in our life, we have different roles to play. So, you know, it's this sense of balance, but just sometimes when the Spirit comes, you know, I remember even listening to a general conference talk where Elder Packer talked about, you know, he's there's some place he was supposed to be, you know, a meeting he was supposed to be, things he was supposed to do, but the Spirit said, no, go help this other person who needs it. And sometimes just that's the case, that the Spirit can help us find the balance and being in the right place at the right time to do this thing that is the most important. There's a passage in Isaiah where the Lord says that my thoughts are higher than your thoughts and my ways higher than your ways, and he compares it to the weather, as you know, as the rain goes forth and the, you know, the seeds and the rains, it's going to bring forth that which I intend. So there's this high level big picture view that he has that also happens to be informed through the atonement of our intimate individual needs at each moment. So if we can tap into that and have the Spirit just to be aware of those promptings that say, this is something that needs to be done, this is something you can do, then the things that we do will have the most lasting significance. You know, even if it's something that, you know, doesn't seem big or noticeable, just sometimes, you know, the right person at the right time giving comfort or saying hello or showing up with something that a person needs, that can be it. And if we can do it that way, then we don't have to have all of the anxiety about it, or, you know, and to get this sense of, you know, what if I'm making a mistake? What if I'm, you know, just, you know, to have a kind of rumination about, am I doing the wrong thing, or am I a sinner, or am I neglecting of this? But to just, we're all in this together, be aware of each other, and be open to inspiration. And we know what the commandments are. You know, we know what is good. We know what is not good. And we just pay attention to what's going on in our world. You know, like this week, you know, this sense that I got. Well, I wrote an essay this week, and it's the first time I've written one this quickly in my life. But, I've just been reviewing a book, and I just got a sense at the start of the week, oh, I know what I want to say. And during the week, you know, got the time to say it, and I looked at it and sent it off Friday, and I'm astounded. But I think when I look at the end product, I feel like this wasn't just me, and this is I think how it works.
And if you could catch it in a bottle and keep it, you would.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Yeah.
John, what do you think?
Well, you have this notion about bearing one another's burdens, and you can help bear the burdens, but only Jesus can actually lift them off, and we're not required to completely lift off the burdens. We're just asked to help bear them. that we do it in a smaller scale. And their people are accountable for their actions. But burdens aren't always a result of somebody's actions. Or aren't the burdens we bear are of an individual and help them out with, and we'll just call her Barbara. And we're going to help Barbara with her burdens. But Barbara's burdens may not be entirely the result of her own actions. And so we help to the extent that we can. And we try to make other people's burdens light. But in the end, it's God that can remove the burden and not us. But we have this covenantal obligation to help them out and to serve them and to mourn with those that mourn and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. And also, especially, to stand as witnesses of God. And if you go back to the discussion of baptism in 2 Nephi 31, that baptism is witnessing before God of our covenant. And so that's the important thing about baptism in the Book of Mormon, is it's a witness unto God, and that we will do certain things, and that we will be obedient. And that's where the focus is on the Book of Mormon. And the baptismal covenant, that's what makes someone, it says, you know, you're willing to be come into the fold of God. It's that baptismal covenant that actually brings us into the fold. The church is the church because it's a collection of people who made covenants with the authority that God has delegated to, and made covenants with Him. And that's what distinguishes us from the church. If we're not willing to keep those covenants, we cut ourselves off from the church. And the church only consists of those who've made those covenants. And that's the one of the key areas in the church, and it's explicitly talked about here in this passage in Mosiah.
Well, a little later we cover the issue of the burdens. There are two different peoples, and their burden of captivity is treated differently by the Lord, we'll be talking about that a little later. So those are good points about that. The issue of covenants, and I've said this before on the air, the idea of being on the covenant path is a phrase that has grown in the church over the last few years. And I really appreciate that phrase, especially when used by the prophet and the apostles, because for a long time I thought, well, yeah, we're people of the book. We have the Bible. We have the Book of Mormon. We have, you know, we have these scriptures that we follow. But I think even more than that, we are people of a covenant. We're people of the new and everlasting covenant, starting with our baptism and going to later covenants. And the whole purpose of the covenants, I think it is basically to organize ourselves in terms to create order out of the chaos that is humanity, if you will, in order to be able to present ourselves unitedly to God. And the membership in the church means we've entered that covenant path, if you will.
Oh, and hopefully we're on it.
sometimes more than others, but yes. So we have Alma and his people in the wilderness, and then we have his people in the wilderness, and we have Limhi and his people who basically are under King Noah first. And then King Noah is killed in a fulfillment of the prophecy by Abinadi that was in some previous chapters. And Kevin, you were pointing out to me earlier some of the differences between the peoples. Tell us a little more about that and how that applies to our studies this week.
Well, I think one of the really interesting things is he's telling two kinds of stories of people who are, end up in captivity. And one of the things that comes out in Limhi's account is that these people brought it on themselves. You know, they make mistakes that they've, you know, their own decisions have, you know, and make things worse. And there's a couple of times when they try to get out by force of arms. And then end up talking about, and they create a whole lot more widows. And that there's a point when they realize that what they have to do is ask God, and then, you know, they're inspired to, Gideon comes up with the idea of, we're gonna get the Lamanites and guards drunk, and we'll all go off. And there's that happy ending to the story. And then it goes right into the Alma's captivity. And these are people who are doing everything right. You know, that they'd come out of the wicked city. They'd become part of the community. They were the ones who went out to the waters of Mormon, and they made the covenant to bear one another's burdens. And then out of the wilderness comes Amulon and his priests with backed up by the Lamanites. So this is, you know, the worst possible thing that could have happened. And it just comes on them. And so they both have this experience of captivity, but it's important to realize that, you know, that on the one hand they're told it is a test of your faith. But in that, you know, with Alma's people, you know, they're told they can't even pray out loud, but they're given the blessing to be able to bear their burdens. You know, that whatever was going on, that they would be able to bear it. And then there just comes the night when they have the miraculous escape, and where the guards would just fall asleep, and they're able to go off and make the 3-week journey to get from the land of Nephi to Zarahemla. And they're put there for us to think about, you know, that you can't judge other people. Why is a bad thing happening to them? Is it because they're wicked, or is it because they're being just the trial of their faith? We can't tell. But in both cases, that they can endure it, they can repent, they can be able to come out on the other side of it and grow from the experience.
So, John, many, many years ago, back in 1992, mm-hmm. you wrote an article about Limhi in the first volume of the Journal of Book of Mormon Study. That doesn't really cover the segment that we have now, but we're still dealing with King Limhi. How does King Limhi figure into this section of the scriptures that we're studying this week?
Well, Limhi is the king over one of these groups. And as we were talking about this, I thought that although it says that they wanted to enter into a covenant, they didn't have anyone with authority, and therefore they couldn't. But they are trying to, in some senses, bear one another's burdens, because Limhi has them support the widows. And so they try to do all of this outside of the covenant, and again, they're delivered. And what I showed in that article is that Limhi quotes a lot of passages from Abinadi
and from scriptures. He quotes a lot of sources. He spent a lot of time looking at records. He's really fascinated with these plates that they can't translate. And so he's really concerned that way. But the section we're dealing with, in some ways, the flip side of that, and this is another article I wrote about 5 years ago, on the hand of the Lord, where Limhi's people, if you look at Noah's people, so Noah's the previous king, and you compare it with the scriptures in Isaiah from about 5 through 10, in that section, it talks about them doing wickedness, and then the Lord is going to smite them, gives them some curse. Susan says, for all of this, his anger, his hand is stretched out still, and he's still angry with his people. And you have that in this account with Limhi, where time out, because of these things that they've done, which just click all the boxes on Isaiah's things that says get you in trouble, and they keep getting smitten because they haven't finally or completely turned to the Lord, and because they've done some really bad things. And so you have a correlation there between the prophecy in Isaiah and that the Lord would keep smiting his people, and sure enough, you can see it fulfilled in Limhi's people.
Is it kind of similar to what we had with Moses and the children of Israel? You know, the children of Israel had left Egypt and had done some really bad things, as you just put it, and they kept getting smited for 40 years until they were all wiped out. I don't think this is on that scale, but still there appear to be some similarities. That would be number one. And number two, is there similarities between Josiah in the Old Testament and Limhi?
That's a good question on Josiah and Limhi.
I'll throw that one to Kevin then, while you're answering.
We can throw that one to Kevin, but
yes.
That they're interested in these records, is there's clearly a parallel there. There's some differences in that Josiah makes some attempts to do things the way that he understands that they ought to be done, and inexplicably he's killed when he goes to battle, doing what ostensibly would be the right thing. And so it's a little different than Limhi, because Limhi he ends up actually being delivered and not dying, but he also doesn't have anybody with authority the way that Josiah does. And so there are some similarities, and there's also some differences between the two rulers and their actions, but they're both trying to be righteous men.
And they're both relying on records that have been lost,
yeah,
or that are new to them, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's one interesting thing about this that would be an interesting contrast between Josiah and what's going on in the book of Mosiah, is that Jack Welch wrote an essay some years ago where he talked about, you know, what is a Mosiah? And it turns out that in Hebrew literature, there's this notion of a Mosiah is a particular kind of hero who delivers his people without recourse to violence. And this unexpectedly, yeah. And turned out to be one of the characteristics of the Book of Mosiah, is that both of these groups, that when they finally make their escapes, when they Limhi's people, it's not through direct battle, and they tried that and failed at least three times.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And they tried that, and it didn't work, and so eventually they...
Yeah, they tried that, and... Yeah, and the trying and failing is one of the things that brought them down into the depths of humility. That's talked about directly in the scriptures, that they had to be really humbled and turned to God. And in the case of the Amos people, again, their deliverance came without recourse to violence. And it's such a distinctive thing in the Book of Mosiah. Yeah, when you mentioned comparisons to Moses, there's places where the Exodus narrative is something about being delivered, let my people go. It isn't said as obviously as that, but there are allusions to what's going on. There are these multiple kinds of Exodus narratives happening, and that's when they see the parallels, and that they kind of see that helps them see themselves as the children of Israel with all of the pros and cons, in the same way that the saints did on our Exodus going from Nauvoo to Salt Lake. And it's the thing that we can do personally in our lives. If we want to come out of Egypt and go to the promised land, then that's recognizing, if we want to become the covenant people, then we have the covenants.
For me, it's I-15
south. Do the covenant.
It's I-15 south.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get away from Babylon, if you will. Of course, if you go too far, you hit the other Babylon. As I would leave Las Vegas whenever I had to go down there for a court appearance or something, I would all, as it receded on the horizon, I would always sing to myself a little song. O Babylon, O Babylon, we bid thee farewell. I won't go into the rest of it, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's worth looking at John's article on Limhi in the library, because it takes an unusual angle on it. Now, it's one of the reasons that I've remembered it after all these years, is that it kind of awakens you to the idea of, why is it he's able to write these things? Why is he telling this particular story in this way? And it's...
Well, John's right here. Let's ask him, John, why were you able to write this thing in this particular way?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about this, or Kevin talked a little bit about this before. It's a whole lot easier to write something if you've got inspiration. And how much of that do you want to take credit for?
Yeah, there is that, yeah.
Yeah, so, Kevin, what was it about the article, though, that really struck you in terms of Limhi?
Well, it's just this angle, what sources is he using? And John's pointing out that it all makes sense, that every occasion where he's quoting, that it would be an occasion where there would be a royal scribe on the scene. So it's not like an omniscient narrator just who knows everything because he's making it up. It's that there's a good reason for everything that's that is quoted to have been recorded by somebody that Limhi would have access to. So it's just this real fine-grained look at how the Limhi's position and the things that he's able to report all make this wonderful, complex, interesting sense. And it's to read through the essay, it's worth doing just because when it awakens you to the complexity and the beauty, and that ultimately for me it helps drives home the reality that these are real people, that this isn't just a story, that this is a record, and so then the reality of their stories reminds me, I'm in this real thing, and I want to tap into this reality, and I want to see these people as living people, and then connect myself to the living God that they know about.
Yeah, for me, John, this essay in this volume was important because I had just gotten out of the military and was back in Zion, even though I was in St. George. And I remember it opened up my eyes to a way of studying the scriptures that I hadn't really thought of before. And I think part of it was Limhi's use of a scribe in this sense. But for me, more important is Mormon has edited this book. We know this isn't the small plates. This is the large plates. So it is a synthesis of a much larger record to take out these snippets, if you will, and there's a very intentional action in putting it together by Mormon, the editor. And what do you think the main message of this, or main theme, if you will, or Moses, Mormon's intent is in terms of putting this in here the way it is? I mean, we have these contrasts we've described. Is there something more to it, or is it part of, once again, this whole idea that undergirds the Book of Mormon, that there's a covenant involved? I mean, there's two main purposes of the Book of Mormon. One is to remind the House of Israel about their covenants and they're not cast off. And the other one is, of course, to, you know, to convince both Jew and Gentile that Jesus Christ is the eternal God, so to speak.
Well, I think there are a number of things that figure in there. Mormon is named after this place where these covenants are made. And so, and he waxes poetic in a couple of spots when he's talking about it. And just like he's very considered in who he names his son after. He doesn't just invent a name. He's not picking a family name per se. He's picking somebody that he knows from history and admires. But I think beyond that, there are a couple of places where this narrative is important because, in a sense, everybody after the Book of Mosiah is converted to Jesus because of the prophecy of the Nephi and his ministry. So Alma, and so you've got this whole line of record keepers who all come into the fold because, starting with Alma the Elder, because of Abinadi. And so it's important for him to tell that story, and but also he is using it to illustrate it. And I think there's a large measure of inspiration in what Mormon chose to do. And there are, if you look at, even if you just look at General Conference talks, the way these stories have been used, they've been used in multiple ways to illustrate multiple points. And I think you have to attribute some of that to Mormon's inspiration. I need to include this. And I'm not sure that Mormon never necessarily recognizes all the reasons why he includes some of the stuff he does. I think he's following the Spirit and says, oh, I need to include this. Oh, and we know he does that with the small plates.
Yeah, he specifically
said. I was going through there and suddenly, you know, I felt impressed to include this record in there as well. So, and there are other times when he's just frustrated because he can't include all the stuff he'd like to include. So, yeah, we can do some second guessing on Mormon, and but I think there's, allow him some inspiration.
I'm not one to second guess.
There are a couple things where he does clearly illustrate it, and one of them is that he says specifically of, and these are his ancestors, of Alma, says, nevertheless, the Lord seeth fit to chasten his people, yea, trieth their patience and their faith. Nevertheless, whosoever putteth his trust in him, the same shall be lifted up at the last day. And that's an editorial comment. One of the reasons why he's including this story. And the other thing is that these stories are referred back to. So, Lumi's people settle in Gideon, across the street from Zarahemla, and when Alma addresses the people in Gideon, he refers back to their deliverance. And when he's talking to his own sons, he refers back to his deliverance. You know, I don't think that Alma was born after they got out of Helam. I think this is part of what he went through, but kind of forgot about for a while as a young man. But that he was there and remembers some of this stuff firsthand. And so this theme of deliverance is something that they're always, that they're referring back to. And it's important to have those stories of the deliverance so you even have a cultural context to know what they're talking about.
Kevin?
Yeah, and one of the things about deliverance, too, is that, you know, I mean, triastically, you know, the whole Book of Mormon, or the whole Book of Mosiah has a structure to it. And I think that Abinadi's testimony is right in the middle, that Abinadi's killed. And yet, Abinadi is the one who's, you know, who understands that this is what's coming, and he accepts it. But he knows that even though he is going to be killed, that he does testify of Christ. And that for him, that's the deliverance. To be delivered from this life into life of Christ is something he's willing to accept. And it has meaning because, you know, it says that, as the story gives, he only got one convert, but that was Alma. And so this thing where if he only had an effect on one person, if that person happened to be someone like Alma, and then what happens after that? Then the things that we do, the sacrifices that we might have to make, or the difficulties we have to endure, they can be meaningful. And if they're meaningful, then we can go through anything.
Well, it's interesting to me that the point that both of you have brought up, and that is the two groups of people. We have Limhi's group. They have a king, but no religious authority. And Alma's group, who has no king, but apparently has religious authority given by God. And then the people with the king and then without the religious authority try a few times and fail to deliver themselves, but then are delivered. And yet the people who have the religious authority, they're chastened anyway. Even though they've repented, they've undertaken the covenant of baptism, and the Lord doesn't free them. He eases their burdens, and I've had some personal experience with that in a way. About 10 years ago, when the financial crisis came, I carried some heavy financial burdens for a while, and we would pray and pray and pray, and they just hung around for a long time. And yet the Lord strengthened us and helped us with our ability to bear up under those challenges. And eventually, in ways that were promised by revelation, you know, we were liberated at least temporarily from those burdens. But it was a very powerful experience to me of what happened with the people of Alma. And yet, it's interesting to note that they were left in their adversity. And the Lord treated them in a different way. So, what is it about the religious authority that Alma had in particular? Because he talked about them having liberty, and then he refused to be their king in chapter 23, and he was their high priest, and he had the authority and so forth, but they fell captive to the Lamanites anyway.
Well, and also they happened to fall captive to the Lamanites just at the time when Limhi's group gets free. It's the same argument me that's chasing after Limhi that ends up bringing them down into captivity. And yet there's... What?
Well, part of that was with regard to the daughters of the Lamanites that had been taken by the wicked
priest
Noah.
Right, but one of the interesting things is, although that's mentioned there, nobody ever brings it up as a grudge thing down the line. That you don't have this division between Alma's group, don't seem to show any resentment towards Limhi's group. Instead, they're rejoicing that they were delivered also.
That's a good point. That's interesting.
Well, I think all of us are happy when someone is delivered.
Yeah. There's this story of the Lamanite daughters being taken away captive. There's a few years ago, you know, I think how relevant is that story to most of us, but then a few years ago when those schoolgirls were taken in Nigeria by Boko Haram, I thought, because there's a lot of members of the church there now in Nigeria, and I've often wondered that, you know, thought that they must read those passages very differently than I did. You know, seeing that as a long ago, far away sort of thing.
Yeah,
have the immediacy of
just
that.
Just happened in our neighborhood last week. Is be their response?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we that one of the reasons we have these scriptures. They say that we can learn from them. They can enlarge our memory and learn to be wiser than they were. But at least having that memory enlarged, we can help give us a perspective on the bad things that do happen and what it takes for deliverance. And
yeah.
I think the key in 24, 15, and 16 kind of summarizes that, John. And now it came to pass that the burdens which were laid upon Alma and his brethren were made light. Yea, the Lord did strengthen them that they could bear up their burdens with ease, and they did submit cheerfully and with patience to all the will of the Lord. And it came to pass that so great was their faith and their patience that the voice of the Lord came unto them again, saying, be of good comfort, for on the morrow I will deliver you out of bondage. And then he does. And he blocks the way of the Lamanites, very similar to the children of Israel. I think there's, you know, this is one of many places in the Book of Mormon where we have that Exodus theme going on. And it reminds me, there was a BYU Studies article about 30 years ago or so that talked about the examples of the Exodus theme in the Book of Mormon. But
yeah.
But that one, I it's interesting. They submitted cheerfully and with patience, and so great was their faith and their patience together that the voice of the Lord came to them. How do we mesh those together, if you will? Kevin?
Well, I just think about some of these interviews that I've seen this week with some of the medical people dealing with this, you know, these terrible burdens that they're doing in dealing with this, the influx of illness in some of these cities and places and death. And yet there's the sense that they know that they're doing something important. You know, at least the ones that I've seen, there's just something tremendously moving to see that kind of commitment and pride in people doing their best to help people in these extreme situations, and, you know, who may be longing for the burden to be lifted someday, but what they want right now is the strength to be able to do it. And we read about literally thousands of people answering a call. Like we were talking about in England, there is a call for, they wanted to have something like 300,000 volunteers to help. They got 750,000 volunteers. when that sort of thing comes up, you know, that's when we realize, yeah, we are in this together. We are part of the community, and we might be able to find God through it.
John?
You know, I don't think I have anything that I'd like to add right now to Kevin's insights on this. You know, but I think many of us can look at these chapters, and if we've experienced deliverance in our own lives, there are details that we pick out that are relevant and poignant and oftentimes difficult to share. But I think that the hardest thing is to be able to read these chapters when you're in the midst and you're aching for that deliverance, and your patience is wearing thin, and being able to come up with the patience that you need, and to know just where are you in the process. You know, are you like Lemmy's people where you just get hit again and again and again, and when does this end? Or, you know, where do you fit when you're in the midst of a trial? Because you don't really know. What they emphasize is that you have to put your trust in God and in His sense of timing.
We had dinner with a friend of ours a couple of months ago down in St. George who has had a lot of challenges within her family, any one of which was just really tough. But when you add them all together, you just look at it and say, where are the boils? You know, I mean, it was very Job-like in these challenges. And yet, in talking to her, that's what she said. She said, I get down to the very bottom where there isn't any more, and somehow I find the Savior there, and that's how I get through this. And so forth. And these are challenges and burdens that in all likelihood in our lifetime will not go away and will have to be sorted out in the next life. But, you know, having that patience is, you know, they always say patience is a virtue. But I think dwelling on the story of Alna in particular, for me, at least for the last 10 years, has been something that has been with me nearly every day. And I think one of the things for me is that it is possible for the people of Alma in a way that it was not for the people of Limhi. The people of Limhi didn't really choose their circumstance. I mean, you know, they were being punished for the actions of their fathers and Noah, and they, like you said, they didn't have the religious authority. But Alma's people chose to get baptized. They chose to enter the covenant. They chose to leave with Alma and to go with him. And then they chose not to make him be a king. I mean, yes, they offered it to him and he rejected it, but they didn't force him. And they chose to be together in the way that they were in light of that covenant. And that, I think, because they chose that, it enabled them to be more patient with their tribulation. And so, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just thinking, one of the other things that you need to remember is where the term patience comes from. It comes from Latin popular, which means suffer. And it's one of these participles, or so it's having patience is suffering. And that's not usually the way we think of it, but etymologically that's what it comes from. So yes, you do being able to endure the suffering that you're going through is number one, never pleasant, and so therefore often a challenge.
In the Latter-day Saint Theology of Suffering, Francis Bunyan gently dismantles the notion that righteousness guarantees a mortal life free from danger and an afterlife with no conflict. Bunyan points out that according to the Latter-day Saint teaching of a premortal struggle between God and Lucifer, the purpose of life is to exercise agency in the face of difficulty. If God were to control and shield our lives from harm at every turn, it would be like living under Lucifer's plan, only one will in control, with no space for us to experience agency and choose our own path. She further writes, I think suffering on this earth is an indication of God's trust, God's love. I think it is an indication that God does not want us to be simply obedient children playing forever under his hand, but wants us to be able to become more like himself. In order to do that, we have to know reality. If we are to be like God, we cannot live forever in fear that we may meet something that will scare us or that will hurt us. Bunyan argues that to experience suffering, to navigate a world of agency-created obstacles and be subject to natural laws, is to live in God's reality. It is to live God's life and mature in it. I mean, a third of the hosts in the pre-existence chose a different path.
Yeah.
That is God's reality, and we often forget that.
Right. So for the listeners who don't know what Terry was quoting from, that was from Melissa Inouye's article in the latest
Interpreter. Came out Friday.
Yeah.
It's called Christ and the Work of Suffering.
So patience and suffering are both etymologically and inextricably interconnected. And those passages you read here are a nice illustration of that. Kevin, I think you had a comment.
I was just thinking there's a passage in Eliade's Cosmos and History, The Myth of Eternal Return, where he says what bothers people isn't so much suffering but meaningless suffering. That's why the examples of people who've gone through it are so important. You know, and I also think of a passage in Lord of the Rings where Sam is talking to Frodo about, he says, there's the stories that really matter. And these are the stories about people getting to that point where you think that there can be no way out, no victory, but yet enduring somehow and somehow getting through it. And those sorts of things give us strength. They give us a model. And they give us a pattern. And that's why we have these stories of people, especially the story of Christ. And that's what the Easter message is finally dealing with, is that all of the greatest enemies that we deal with, he has overcome. And we follow him, and we can get through anything. And that'll be any suffering, any loss, any challenge, to be able to do it with hope. That's Easter.
Yes. Couldn't say it better, Kevin. It is, and as we mentioned at the beginning of our broadcast tonight, it is Easter. And even though it's the evening and we're wrapping up the entire weekend, it's been a great spiritual feast for me, as well as I hope for all of you. And Kevin, or John, you mentioned an Eastern Orthodox tradition that we started off with. You want to tell that to the listeners again, for those who may have joined
late?
Okay.
Well, I'm going to pick up on something that Kevin mentioned first.
Yeah.
Because he's talking about Tolkien. Tolkien was a Catholic and a believing Catholic.
And they talk about stories that matter. Well, Christ is a story that matters because it actually happened. As great as some of Tolkien's stories were, they didn't really happen. But the story of Christ really happened. And so the Eastern Orthodox greeting is you say to someone, usually in that Orthodox language, whether it's Greek or Russian or whatever, Christ is risen. And the response is, truly, he is risen. And that's the way they greet each other on Easter. And that's at least my testimony and my greeting, in this case, a farewell greeting on this Easter Sunday, is Christ is risen. He is truly risen.
Truly, he's risen. Thank you, John. Thank
truly, you, he has risen. Thank you.
All of you, thank you for joining us. This is Terry Hutchinson with my co-hosts, John Gee and Kevin Christensen, signing off from Interpreter Radio. Please join us again next week.